You're listening to The Point. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with David Schenck, who is the creator and executive producer of Living with Alzheimer's, a series of short films. Also in studio with us, Sean Corcoran, WCAI senior reporter and editor, and Greg O'Brien, a Cape Cod journalist who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's 4 years ago. Sean, we've did several series on this. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference between the early onset and generally you don't get diagnosed with something like this until you're over 65.
Yes, generally that's correct. The overwhelming number of people with Alzheimer's are diagnosed after age 65, though the latest research indicates that the pathology, the stuff happening up in the brain, happens years earlier, 15, 20 years earlier. It's starting to build up, and then when there's enough of it in the brain, that's when the symptoms display themselves. But early onset or familial Alzheimer's, which comes between age 40 and 65 typically, a lot of times they can pin exactly when that's going to happen based on what has happened with your mother or your father or your people in your family. That is a particularly sad disease. It can be anticipated, but it's so important in finding a cure or new therapies when you can anticipate when the disease is going to actually strike, when the symptoms are going to show up. You can start to try to address it earlier and see if you can delay those symptoms. Because when it comes with regular onset Alzheimer's, they think if they can delay it by 10 years or 15 years, that might be long enough that you can live out your regular life. And so that's where a lot of the science is now.
Yeah. David, I'm curious, you wrote a book on this, you've got the short films. Was there someone in your family that, I mean, how did you get so connected with Alzheimer's disease?
My story is pretty unusual. Most of the people that I meet in the Alzheimer's world did get dragged into it through a family member. That doesn't sound right, but he'd get brought into this world one way or another through a family experience. I haven't had that yet. I'm knocking on some wood here. I actually overheard a conversation in Brooklyn where I live, and I was one of those billions of people who've heard of Alzheimer's disease, and up to that moment, just did my best not to think about it. Everyone has heard of the disease and knows kind of the very basics of how it's a disease of memory that kind of takes your brain away from you. But no one wants to think about it if they don't have to, and I was certainly in that camp. And I overheard a conversation that was actually about a couple dealing with the disease. The gentleman was roughly Greg's age, actually. So he had early onset Alzheimer's disease, and he was in the late stages of the disease, but still living at home, and his wife was taking care of him. And the key fact that I overheard, and I'm just in this story, I'm just a nosy journalist, just like Greg. I overheard them saying that the wife that the husband did not even recognize his own wife, even though they were still sharing the same home together. And that haunting fact pushed me back to my office to start asking a series of questions that a few years later ended up being my book, The Forgetting.
I think David makes a good point. Most people that we do find in this area came to it because of a family member. We've done three series of stories here at WCAI about the disease, and it wasn't that I have a family member either. It was someone called me up and said to me, "Do you know how much money the federal government spends on research into Alzheimer's each year?" And I had no idea. I threw out a guess, and it was around $500 million a year. It's gone up and down over the years. I think it almost licked $700 million at one point, but it's never reached $1 billion. It's not comparable to other major diseases and investments into finding cures for them and preventatives and treatments where they've had success with other diseases. And if you've been around a while, you know that for the federal government, $500 million is not a lot of money.
Yeah.
In California, they're building high schools for $100 million, and this is a disease that threatens will bankrupt not only the United States economy, but other economies. China has a major problem with Alzheimer's disease because the numbers of people they have there. So for me, it was, how could this be? Let's look into it. And then you start down the road and you start to find out, well, what are these caregivers doing? They're so overwhelmed, they can't go out and advocate for themselves. Certainly the patients, most of them, can't go out and advocate for themselves for very long. And then it was, well, where is the science? Where are the cures? Where are the preventatives? So that's how we kind of went down the Alzheimer's road here at WCAI.
Yeah. Mary Lou is giving us a call from Chatham. Good morning, Mary Lou.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I am so blessed because my mom's mother, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She was eventually went into a nursing home. I used to bring my children into the nursing home to visit her, and they had so much fun. The children would take them, build little castles or little blocks or whatever we brought there, and she would knock them over, and they would all be laughing, and it was such a joy to be able to see and connect her with my grandchildren.
Yeah.
And then my children, and then my mom was declared to have Alzheimer's, and she went into a nursing home as well. But her sister, who also told me that a brother in that family also had Alzheimer's and was diagnosed with it after he had passed away, because basically I guess they couldn't diagnose them while they had it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they did find that he did have it. But my aunt, she told me, she says, connect with your mother somehow, some way. Just connect with her while you know this is all happening.
Yeah.
And I used to call her every morning, and I'd say, Ma, look up at your windows and tell me what you see. And she would say, I see the sun shining. I says, that's me smiling at you. Yes. That's your daughter smiling at you. And any time when she ended up in the nursing home and I'd go in to visit her, she would smile at me. And my sisters would say, how come she smiles at you but not at me? I says, that's because you have got to connect with them.
Mm, yeah.
So that's part of my story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Mary Lou, thank you. Greg, did you want to say
something?
Very
well. Yeah, I think Mary Lou is so right. I noticed that about my mother, and I would just urge anyone to just keep the conversation up with people, and I believe that you can find a way to communicate with people. I have a nephew who's severely autistic, and he texts me in the middle of the night.
Mm.
And I would go and I would talk to my mother even when she wasn't able to communicate. And you could see in her eyes that she knew
something
what was going
clicked,
on.
Yeah.
And just a quick anecdote, right before she died, the nurses called me to Epic Nursing Home in Brewster and said, your mother is very upset. She's nervous. And I thought this was the end. So I went in at 9:30 and woke her up. I said, Mom, I'm sorry to wake you up. And she said, she mentioned my name. She said, it's okay, Greg. And there was a continence about her. And I waited till she fell asleep and I kissed her on the forehead and her little eyes popped open. This gets back to what Mary Lou was talking about. And she said, where are you going, Greg? And I realized then that she was on her way out. Mm. And I said, Mom, I'm not going anywhere. We're going to ride this one out together.
Mm.
I held her hand till she fell asleep. I kissed her, and I never saw her again.
Wow. Mm. You know, David, this kind of goes back to the films. We talked about the film with the preschoolers. But there's also this other film, Let the Band Play On, which sort of conveys that message of living in the moment. But there is that, so for some reason, that music really connects with many Alzheimer's patients.
Music is one of the things that we can hold on to the longest. Maybe the thing we can hold on to the longest. And, you know, there's a common theme that's really going through this entire conversation, and I want to jump on it, which is, you know, there are an awful lot of people out there, unfortunately, some of them listening, who have every ability intact, who don't make a lot of, you know, connections with people in their lives for whatever reason, and what you see in the Alzheimer's world is, you know, people struggling with this slow narrowing of ability, but the richness of human connection lives on. And in fact, in many cases, because of the disease and because of, you know, the finite amount of time left and so forth, it brings people closer together, and you end up seeing, witnessing just absolutely extraordinary experiences, and people can live not only continually rich lives with this disease, but in some ways even richer lives in their final years. So that's one of the messages that we wanted to convey.
Mm-hmm.
But I completely ignored your question about Naomi Boak's amazing film. about the ballroom dancing, which is just an extraordinary, extraordinary little film that about a center in on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where they have a lot of dementia patients living there full time, and their loved ones come back, their spouses and kids and so forth, come back once a week and dance with them with the help of a professional ballroom dancer. And they play the old tunes that everyone will remember throughout their entire lives, no matter what level of dementia they're at. And the spark of life that you see in that room and that you feel in that room, I mean, there's just no place you'd rather be as a witness. It was just such a privilege to see that happen and to film it.
They really, David, they're really wonderful films. They're not overwhelmingly sad. I mean, the best stories are the ones where you walk away from it and something from it sticks with you days, weeks, months later. I think that happened with every single one of these films that I saw. One of the things that family members, caregivers often talk about is the importance of having a conversation with your loved one who's been diagnosed or is having issues before the disease progresses too far, so you know what that person's wishes are. And I was wondering, Greg, if you've had that conversation with your family, and as someone who's seen this disease play out a couple times in your life and others, what did you express what your wishes are as the disease progresses?
Yeah, you have to – you want to be protective, okay? So you live in a world of denial. So I'll be honest with you. My denial at some level, and David might understand this. I mean, I know, I don't know who the guy who said denial just ain't a river in Egypt, but you guys will remember that, but it's in my book, and I've had conversations with my kids and my wife, and, you know, my son Brendan, who may be on the phone, he's in Boston, he's been very helpful, as Colleen and Connor have, and my wife Mary Catherine, and we always find a way in the family to cut through kind of the Irish grim humor. And so when I told the kids, my son Connor, who's 24, looked at me in full love and he said, "So Dad, you're nuts." And it broke the ice, and that's all I needed to know. He said it with love, and I knew what he meant.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that film, Let the Band Play On, one of the stories in there, David, is about, I think the woman's name was Julia, and you interview her husband, and he talks about the difficulty of making the decision of placing her in this, I guess, residential facility. But he said he feels good about it because he sees her, especially in these ballroom dancing, and she's happy. He said he knows that she's happy. I thought that was a nice story, talking about the struggle he had, but then, being able to let go and let her have this, peace that she has at the facility.
Yeah, and that touches on an absolutely universal experience in Alzheimer's, which is this, at a certain point, unless you are extraordinarily wealthy, and I don't mean in love, I mean in actual, economic resources, it becomes awfully difficult to take care of someone. Unless you can afford not to have any job in your family at all and be a full-time caregiver and pay all the expenses and bring in extra help, at some point, almost every family needs to find some outside facilities. And in many, many, many cases, the families have made explicit promises to the patient along the way that they would never do that,
right?
Because that's what people want to hear, that they would never be sent to a facility. So it becomes this really wrenching decision. I know what the best thing is for me and for my wife, but I promise not to do this, and it feels like I'm just breaking this sacred code. And and what we see in that film is the husband who knows it's the right thing, but was so uneasy about it. And over time, as he sees his wife settle into this facility and gets to visit her and experience these really amazing moments of joy and witness so many moments of joy, he knows in his heart that he did the right thing and that he's doing the absolute best thing for for his wife, and yeah. and that's a really rich thing to see, and I think an important lesson for families.
Yeah, Pat Collins is on the line. She's a certified dementia practitioner with Hope Dementia and Alzheimer's Services. Good morning, Pat.
Hi. Good morning, Mindy.
So, have you seen the films, Pat?
Oh yes.
Oh yeah. So this speaks a lot to, I guess, what you do with families. I mean, it's a tough diagnosis, and you know, it takes a while for all that to settle in.
It certainly is. I am part of Hope Dementia and Alzheimer's Services. I'm the director of Family and Community Outreach, and we're part of the Hope Health healthcare organization. And we provide support, counseling, care planning, and education for caregivers and those living with dementia. Greg has been part of our family for many, many years, I think from the earliest time of his diagnosis. And a couple of things, if I can, Mindy,
sure, sure.
I'd like to touch on. Sean brought up the federal budget dollars that are actually applied to Alzheimer's disease, and they just received an increase in 2014. The federal budget for Alzheimer's research is $684 million. Now, we know that there was a study done between 2000 and 2010 that showed that the mortality rate for Alzheimer's had increased 68%. It had increased 68%, and yet here we are in 2014 with only $684 million budgeted mm-hmm. for what the NIH director last year declared Alzheimer's as being its number one priority. Hmm. The numbers there are very skewed.
Yeah.
One of the important things that we do, as David mentioned earlier, he said it's not as if your life ends. It's a very long journey. It is, and there is a terrible stigma attached to it. So Hope Dementia and Alzheimer's Services, as part of the Hope Health family, is able to provide a number of programs. We do provide art and music programs for families living with Alzheimer's because we do know that they stimulate conversation, and conversation is critical.
Mm-hmm.
We have many, many support groups, and in order to enable caregivers on Cape Cod to get to a support group with their peers of others dealing with loved ones with Alzheimer's disease, we created a program called CARES, where the person with the diagnosis also attends a support group.
Hmm. Yeah.
And these are folks who range from fairly early diagnosis to those who have developed aphasia
yeah.
during the progression of their disease.
Yeah, Pat, you know, we'll put a link up on our website to your website so folks can get more information. And thank you so much for calling in. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Greg's son, Brendan.